Thank you very much for the invitation and the opportunity to come to this institute, which is the first time I've been here. I hope that those of you who are here won't inform my employer, King's College, about the fact that I'm talking to an applied maths group and a philosophy group, since they don't actually know. Sorry?
You might get a raise.
Well, that's one possibility, yes. The topic I'm going to talk about has got a numerical background, and there is a previous paper which includes lots of numerical details showing that the kind of approach which I'm going to talk about can be carried through in numerical detail for at least some non-self-adjoint heat equations. But I'm not going to talk about that aspect of the subject today. I just want to mention it because you might have some doubts about whether something which I'm going to start off with talking about in a very abstract functional analytic way is actually capable of being useful. So I'm hoping that you will agree that, or at least suspend belief, that there is a possibility that the kind of approach to solving heat equations or linear evolution equations could be useful. The starting point, as I said, is going to be purely functional analytic, and I'm going to have to, in the course of the lecture, describe what the various functions and operators are, or how they're going to be constructed if one's given a differential operator. Might also be useful to have this, because this that's got a fan on it, which is going to
blows away the paper, and a fan on either side.
But that, if I move that over here, that will be safer. Okay, so the question of interest will be that one's given a linear operator A, and this is the infinitesimal generator of an evolution semigroup, or one's looking at a heat equation, so A will, in the numerical examples, be a second-order non-self-adjoint differential operator in any number of dimensions, and one wants to solve the heat equation, and I'm going to assume that somehow or other, and I will have to tell you how later on, at least in some, to some extent, there is an approximate spectral representation of this operator, even though it's non-self-adjoint and highly non-normal. So one assumes that there is an L2 space or an LP space. In fact, I will want to refer only to P equals 1 and 2 here. There's an LP space on some set omega, and an embedding operator, capital E, from the LP space to the Hilbert space, and a multiplication operator given by capital lambda with a multiplication function sigma, such that you have this error for some epsilon. Now, H is an abstract Hilbert space, which will be the L2 space in which the differential operator acts. Now, if the operator were self-adjoint or even normal, then you could take E to be the unitary operator from the L2 space to the Hilbert space, and sigma would be the multiplication operator, which gives you the spectral diagonalization of the normal operator, and you could take epsilon equals zero. I'm not going to be interested in letting epsilon converge to zero here. The question of what size epsilon should be will depend on how good your computer is, but let us say 10 to the minus 8, halfway between the 16-digit accuracy that you can get with common processors, and and nothing at all. So we're not going to be letting epsilon go to zero. We're going to be taking a particular epsilon which is going to be staying fixed throughout the whole of the talk. So in the case of a normal operator, you could put epsilon equals zero. You could take E to be unitary, and lambda is the, or little sigma is the function which describes the diagonalization of the operator A. And the interesting thing then is that the essential range of the function sigma coincides with the spectrum of the operator A. Now, in this non-normal context, highly non-normal context, I have to warn you that E is going to be bounded but not invertible. It's going to have dense range, and the function sigma will have no relationship to the spectral representation of the operator at all. The essential range of the function sigma will be almost entirely unrelated to the spectrum of the linear differential operator A. And this is the surprising fact, which is that it's possible to attain an approximate diagonalization of this ray with a function whose essential range has no connection with the spectrum of A, which is related to a notion of pseudospectrum popularized and developed by Trefethen, who is now a numerical analysis professor in Oxford, and which I will talk about a little later on. So I will have, in the particular case, to provide you with some algorithms for defining the operator capital E, defining the function little sigma, once you're given a differential operator A. But before doing that, let me say why one should be interested in doing that. So if you know that A is a generator of a one-parameter semigroup, then you might want to solve the evolution equation or find an approximate representation of the operator capital T. And the theorem is that you can use the approximate function capital lambda, and you can exponentiate that, but since capital lambda is a multiplication operator, is an easy thing to do, and then you get a representation, approximate representation of the semigroup T sub T with an actual specified error. And clearly, if you know what epsilon is, it's 10 to the minus 8, then this will be a reasonable approximation for a certain length of time. The smaller epsilon is, the longer the time that this will be a reasonable representation for. Now, that's not a difficult theorem. I'll just put up the proof here. It's only a few lines. Standard sort of representation of the difference as being an integral from 0 to t, and then you just estimate the various terms and you come out with the answer. So the point is not that this is a deep result, but that if only you can find an appropriate operator E and appropriate multiplication operator capital lambda, then this will give you a good way of approximating the evolution for a reasonable length of time. Okay, now the big problem with that theorem as it stands, let me just put it back up again for a moment, is that it tells you how to calculate TT applied to E phi. But you're not likely to want to evaluate TT applied to E phi. You want to evaluate TT applied to your initial choice of data, not something for which you already know what phi is. But that's, again, not a terribly difficult task to rectify. So once you have that theorem, you can write down this one, in which you are given the initial data F, and you want to see how it evolves up to time t, and you get an estimate of this kind. Phi is still in the statement of the theorem, but you do not actually specify it, so this is true for all phi, and obviously you will get the best approximation by minimizing the right-hand side with respect to phi. Now, the obvious thing to do is to look at the first term, F minus capital E phi, and to find the phi which minimizes the error. In other words, you try to get the best approximation to F of the form E phi. This is not the right thing to do, because if you look at the second term, you get the norm of phi there. And it turns out that if E does not have a bounded inverse, and it will not have in the kind of applications we are talking about, then as you try to get a better and better approximation to this term on the right-hand side, the norm of F minus E phi, you find that the optimization of phi makes the other term, norm phi, get bigger and bigger. So you have to make a compromise between the two. You have to find a phi which makes the first term on the right-hand side small, but doesn't make the second term too big. But on the second term, you already have an epsilon there, so that gives you the possibility of having norm phi fairly large, but the second term still being small. Now, these are all aspirations, of course. I mean, the question of whether one can actually achieve anything useful from this is something that I'm not going to provide you with the numerical examples, and I have to ask you to trust me. So this is basically a scheme. So if you want to minimize the right-hand side, there is a standard procedure for dealing with this kind of thing, which is you now try to minimize the expression F minus E phi norm squared plus delta norm phi squared, where delta is a small number. We had it as being roughly epsilon t before. This is can be achieved in two ways. Now, if one is simply asking for a numerical minimization, then there is a MATLAB routine called backslash, which says that if you have a linear operator from one space to another, then you find the phi, which gives you the best approximation to the thing on the right-hand side, for which E tilde phi is the best approximation to the thing on the right-hand side. E tilde is defined as this particular combination of E phi plus delta the half phi. So if you're going to be using MATLAB, you simply invoke the backslash operator. And you must definitely use E tilde, not E. If you try to use E backslash F, you will get something for which phi has got an extremely large norm and it just won't work. I mean, this is what I did originally and it didn't work. If you want, however, not to do it using numerical methods, but want to write down the actual answer, then the actual answer is given by this slide. Phi is given by F sub delta of F, where F sub delta is this expression. But this is not the right way to work it out numerically. I mean, you should not calculate E star E plus delta 1 and then calculate the inverse and then multiply it by E star. I mean, MATLAB backslash routine works far better. Whether you regard this mathematical proposition as interesting or not depends on whether you're interested in the sort of theory or the numerics of it. But in either case, you can find the best phi to give you an approximation of the type which I just described. Well, the backslash routine is an algorithm of MATLAB which is trying by an iterative procedure to minimize the Hilbert space norm of E tilde phi minus F. Yes. Yes, it's at least, well, because we're in a Hilbert space context, it's a least squares error estimator. But you should put in the extra delta term because otherwise the thing gets out of control. It's a regularized inverse, in other words. Now, I haven't given you any idea about how to define the operator capital E or the function sigma. And I should have said that right at the beginning. So let's give you go back to the beginning and give you a little bit of motivation from the from here. This is where I started. I had a space capital omega, an LP space. I haven't told you what capital omega is going to be. Let us think of the particular application. A is going to be a second-order non-self-adjoint elliptic differential operator, or if you prefer, it could be a general pseudo-differential operator. Capital omega will be the phase space well, so the Hilbert space H will be the L2 space of whatever you're working on. Capital omega will not be the whole of the phase space. It'll be actually be a certain path of the phase space, which you identify using Hormander commutator condition I will describe later. So the function sigma is actually the symbol of the differential operator. Now, the range of the symbol is not the same as the spectrum of the differential operator. In fact, they're very different from each other. But so the range of sigma is a certain set in the complex plane, but we're interested in little omega being a parameterization running over phase space, and capital E, I haven't told you how to define it at all, but it's something like a coherent state representation. So for each point in the phase space, you have to produce a vector in the Hilbert, a vector in the Hilbert space, and you should think of this as being like a coherent state representation, but it's a coherent state representation which is adapted to the particular differential operator, so that this sort of estimate can hold. Now let's continue. How are we going to define capital E? Well, so it's going to be a coherent state representation, or something like a coherent state representation. For each point omega of the phase space, you have to produce a unit vector in the Hilbert space on which the operator acts, and then you integrate those unit vectors with respect to the weight function phi. And the condition, the commutator condition that I want, so AE minus E lambda, intertwining condition, I suppose, is associated with requiring that each of these E omegas is an approximate eigenvector for the differential operator. So the task is, for each point in phase space, or at least for certain points in phase space, I have to try to construct an approximate eigenvector for the differential operator, where the approximate eigenvalue is the value of the symbol at that point of phase space. The question is this possible, and how does one go about doing it? Now, this statement, I said these two things are equivalent, the operator committee intertwining estimate and getting a sequence, a family of approximate eigenvectors are equivalent, but only in the p equals 1 case. We actually are going to be working, and so far I've been talking mainly in the p equals 2 case, but if you assume that the set omega that you work in on is a finite measure, in other words, you restrict to a certain part of the phase space, then it doesn't really make too much difference whether you use p equals 1 or p equals 2. Of course, in a numerical context, you will not be able to use the whole of the phase space. You will have to take a certain lattice in phase space, a finite lattice in phase space. So in a numerical context, you will select a reasonably large number of approximate eigenvectors, each of them parameterized by a certain point in phase space, and you will have to choose which ones to take. Okay, so that's going to be the task. Can we construct an approximate eigenvector for each point in phase space, or for certain points in phase space, and what conditions do you need? And this is where the semi-classical analysis will come in. Now, I want to relate what I'm doing to something which you might think is the same, but actually it's rather different. Well, if you have if the original operator acts on L2 of a compact manifold, then the phase, you're looking at the phase space of that compact manifold, which is the cotangent bundle with a canonical measure. Sigma. Will you have an elliptic differential operator, and this has a symbol, which is a function on the cotangent bundle of the torus.
So omega is on the cotangent bundle of the torus.
Omega is a part of the cotangent bundle of the torus. Well, if it's a flat torus, you're right, yes. But in the more general case, I mean, you will have a function which is a matrix with respect to the position variables, you've got the psi squared with respect to the momentum variables. So we're talking about the classical phase space of a compact manifold. And the symbol sigma is a symbol in the semi-classical context that you look at pseudo-differential operators. You construct them out of a semi-classical symbol, which is a function on the phase space. I'm going to actually talk about that next, really, because I want to actually make a connection between the kind of thing I'm talking about here and what people do when they quantize a semi-classical symbol. So you commonly have a situation something like this, where you take the E omegas actually to be coherent states associated. If you're in Euclidean space, then you have a coherent state, a Gaussian wave packet associated with each point of phase space, which is centered at a particular point in position space and which has an appropriate momentum associated to a parameter in momentum space. And then if you have a function on the phase space, you define a function on the L2 of the position space by a formula of that type. And that gives you an operator E. Now, this is a very classical notion, and there are several theorems which go back to the 70s and possibly 60s and 50s too, about the properties of an operator of that type. So I've already told you basically the first one, that if you regard it as a map from L1 functions on the phase space to the Hilbert space, then its norm is given by the sup of the norms of the vectors E sub omega. If, however, you regard it as a map from the L2 space, then you get a formula of this type, and you get the adjoint is isometry if and only if this holds. Now, this is the standard formula for an overcomplete family of states, of the kind which you get with Gaussian coherent states. So here again, in the classical interpretation of this kind of overcomplete family of states, the Hilbert space will be L2 of Rn, but omega will be R2n. Rn cross Rn, the first n variables being the position variables, the second n being the momentum variables. Now, when people do standard quantization in the semi-classical context, they start off by taking a function on the phase space, which is the symbol, and they associate an operator with it by means of this formula. So this can also be written as EMF E star. So, I mean, I'm claiming that this is one of the standard quantizations which gives you a pseudo-differential operator on the Hilbert space associated with a symbol on the phase space. And it has the feature that if the function F is bounded, then the operator is bounded. I mean, that's fairly clear. If F is a bounded function, then multiplication by it is a bounded function. And so the operator is a bounded function. If you start off with the identity function, you get the identity operator. But this kind of quantization isn't an algebra homomorphism. It's simply something which takes you from a classical symbol to the pseudo-differential operator associated with that classical symbol. But notice here that the formula I'm writing down is EMF E star. This is not the kind of thing which I am actually trying to do here. I am trying to associate with each function on the phase space an operator SF which is given by EMF E inverse, not EMF E star. Now, I can't actually do that because the operator capital E in the applications is not going to be invertible. And so I have, instead of writing down E inverse, I have to write down an approximation to E inverse. That's what I'm constructing. So it seems to have some similarity with one of the types of quantization maps from symbols to pseudo-differential operators, but it's actually quite different. If I could actually write down the formula for SF given here, and if E inverse were defined properly, then I would have an algebra homomorphism. It would not be positivity preserving, but it would be an algebra homomorphism. Whereas the other one is always defined, but it's not anything even remotely close to being an algebra homomorphism. Okay. Well, I mean, this has all been rather abstract. And it is built upon the hope that for every given a differential operator or a pseudo-differential operator, and given a point in phase space, one can produce an approximate eigenfunction associated to that point in phase space. And I'm now going to be moving towards the discussion of when you can produce approximate eigenvectors associated with certain approximate eigenvalues, and what these have to do with the spectrum, or what they don't have to do with the spectrum. How many of you have actually heard of Trefethen's work on pseudospectra? Rather few. Yes. Same. Okay. So the whole thing depends upon the possibility of producing an eigenfunction or an approximate eigenfunction associated with each point in the phase space associated with this pseudo-differential operator. And I have to tell you how to do it. So let's say, what are pseudospectra? Now, it's a notion which was invented or discovered in the late 70s, but really only got going in any very serious way around 1990, and it's been very much pushed by Trefethen, and if you type in the word pseudospectra into Google, you will almost certainly be taken to his website on the subject, which is gives you a full explanation of the topic. So he brings in this notion of pseudospectrum, a psylum spectrum. You choose your psylum, and then you ask whether you can, for any particular z, whether you can find an approximate eigenvector in that sense. So this depends on the choice of psylum. Now, if you put epsilon equals zero, you're asking for the actual spectrum. Well, you're actually asking for the eigenvalues, but in a finite dimensional context, you would be asking for the spectrum. But if you take a positive epsilon, then for each positive epsilon, you're talking about a certain region in the complex plane. And the whole point of the theory is that the region, even for epsilon is quite small, maybe 10 to the minus 20 here, this region can be vastly bigger than the spectrum itself. You can find points quite commonly which are a long way away from the spectrum, for which nevertheless you get approximate eigenvectors. You shouldn't think of approximate eigenvectors as being close to true eigenvectors. They're just not in many typical non-self-adjoint contexts. And that's what makes the whole of what I'm talking about work. I discovered this first for an example which I became a bit famous for, at least, you know, with in the sense that any mathematician can become famous. This is a non-self-adjoint operator, non-self-adjoint harmonic oscillator. If you take C to be a complex number rather than a positive real number, then you can ask about the epsilon pseudospectrum in this context. Now, making C complex, you would have thought, would have made no difference to anything. You know exactly what the eigenfunctions and eigenvalues are for this operator. You can do analytic continuation in C, and you get exactly what you would expect. The eigenvalues are c to the half times 2n plus 1, and the eigenfunctions are still Gaussians times Hermite polynomials with the appropriate powers of c in various places. So as far as the spectral analysis of this operator is concerned, there appears to be nothing interesting going on at all. But when you actually look at it in a bit more detail, you discover, in fact, it's rather surprisingly pathological. For example, the linear span of the eigenfunctions is certainly dense, and that's what you mean by being complete, but it does not form a basis in the Hilbert space except for the case of positive real C. That means you cannot expand an arbitrary L2 function as a convergent series in terms of the eigenfunctions. The eigenfunctions do not have the sort of properties you'd think that they ought to have. Indeed, the spectral projections, the norms of the spectral projections increase exponentially fast as n increases. Now, in the self-adjoint case with C positive, of course, the spectral projections are orthogonal. They all have norm 1. But as soon as C becomes complex, the norms increase exponentially fast. Here is a picture of the pseudospectra for this operator. Now, everything inside the outside curve, the dots are obviously the eigenvalues, everything inside the outside curve is in the psylum pseudospectrum for psylum equals 1. The next curve is the psylum equals a tenth, then a hundredth, then a thousandth, 10,000, 100,000, millionth. So everything inside that large inner curve there exists an approximate eigenvector with the eigenvalue being whatever point in the complex plane you choose inside that curve, for which the error of psylum is less than 10 to the minus 6. By the time you get up to the rather strange dots up here, which are counterfactual, there are anywhere up in that part of the curve, there are approximate eigenvectors for which the error is of order 10 to the minus 12. Now, if you're using a processor which can only work out to one part in 10 to the 16, then the software for calculating eigenvalues of non-self-adjoint matrices is unreliable, it's just unable to tell the difference between genuine eigenvalues and apparent eigenvalues, which is why you get these spurious bifurcation of the apparent eigenvalues for this operator. Now, if you say you're not going to... So once you get up to about the 30th eigenvalue for this complex case, it's almost impossible to calculate the eigenvalues by any standard package. If you are able to work with quadruple precision arithmetic, then you can get up to 40 or 50 eigenvalues. But, you know, because at each curve here, it's a factor of 10 extra, you're not going to get very far unless you are willing to use infinite precision arithmetic. The fact that the norms of the spectral projections increase exponentially fast is obviously related to that fact. That was actually the first example I ever did. There is software for calculating pseudospectra. That's the website. And here is another typical example, an all-Sommerfeld operator, highly non-self-adjoint operator, with the eigenvalues illustrated by dots, various curves, and these curves go up by a factor of, well, I don't know what. This is 1, 3, 4, 5, 6, those probably powers of 10. Each curve is probably a power of 10 more than the one before. So there are quite large regions which are not close to the eigenvalues for which there are nevertheless approximate eigenvectors. Okay. Now, that example of Trefethen, taken from his website, is nothing particularly to do with semi-classical analysis. And what I want next to do is to tell you how to actually produce these approximate eigenvectors. Yes. Right. So in the case of a self-adjoint or normal operator, the epsilon pseudospectrum is the epsilon neighborhood of the spectrum. And for a general operator, the epsilon pseudospectrum can be much bigger than that, and these examples show how, in fact, you can be much bigger. It can be bigger by an order of 10 to the 20. I mean, you know, that's the sort of thing you can have. Even by the time you get to the 30th eigenvalue for an absolutely straightforward operator which doesn't look as if it could possibly be causing any problems. Now, I want... Trefethen's notion of pseudospectrum needs to be generalized because we want to parameterize not by complex numbers but by points of phase space. So for each point in phase space, little omega, I have to have an operator which I will write down in a moment, and I want to be able to talk about the spectrum as a subset of phase space and the pseudospectrum as being a subset of phase space as well. So if we have a family of operators parameterized by omega in phase space, the spectrum will be defined as the set of omegas for which that operator is not invertible. The pseudospectrum will be defined by the formula that I've just written down, and this will be a part of phase space which contains the spectrum. This is the appropriate way of generalizing things. Okay, so now at last we'll get to back to reality, or what I think passes for reality. So how are we going to define this operator? I have to, H is going to be the usual semi-classical parameter, small positive number. U is a position space parameter, Xi is a momentum space parameter, and I'm now going to define the operator, which starts off with a function. Q is a position operator. You look at Q jth component minus U jth component, and then all of those, and then the corresponding thing for the momentum operators. And finally, the third term in A is LH minus the symbol of the differential operator evaluated at U and Xi. And according to the definition of the pseudospectrum, what we're trying to do is to simultaneously find a function for which the position is of that function is concentrated around the point U, the momentum is concentrated around the point Xi, and the function is an approximate eigenvector of the differential operator, the approximate eigenvalue being the symbol of the differential operator at that point in phase space. So the question is it possible, given an arbitrary point U Xi in phase space, to find a function which is simultaneously concentrated around U in position space, Xi in momentum space, and also is an approximate eigenvector for the differential operator? This may seem to be rather a lot to hope for, but I'm going to show you how to do it. I'm now going to be absolutely concrete. I'm going to go down to one dimension because it reduces the notation, and I'm going to concentrate on second-order differential operators with a suitable appearance of H in the various places, so for which the semi-classical principal symbol is as I've written it down there. So this is a variable coefficient operator of second order, and I'm going to assume that all the coefficients can be complex and that it's elliptic in the sense that the leading order coefficient never vanishes. The analysis I'm going to do is a local analysis, so I don't need to make any assumptions about the behavior of the coefficients at infinity, but I will assume that the coefficients are all smooth. And so given that sort of structure, I want to produce an approximate eigenfunction which is localized around a given point in phase space. This idea, I thought it was my idea. Well, it was my idea. I had the idea of doing this about 4 years ago, and I did it in one dimension, and then I spoke to Zvorsky about it, and after his saying that it was obviously completely impossible for 2 days in a conference in Edinburgh, on the third day he told me it was obvious, it was well known, and Hormander had done it in 1970. but he just hadn't thought of it this way, and nor had Hormander thought of it this way. But what Hormann had done was actually to prove that this was possible in another context. The whole idea has now been taken up by Svorsky, Sjostrand, Denker, and it's been pushed in various directions I never even contemplated. So the task is to write down the appropriate F and to show that it just has the required property. And you do it by using standard WKB methods. So this is going to be the approximate eigenfunction. The Xi of S doesn't really matter. It's just a cutoff function which stops things blowing up at infinity. And then I have an H to the minus a quarter, which also doesn't matter. But the thing which does matter is the thing inside the exponential, which notice starts off with a term H to the power minus 1. So the leading term is H to the minus 1 Psi minus 1. And we are going to suppose, as an ansatz, that you have a function of that type, put it into the differential operator as an eigenvalue, as an eigenvalue equation, the eigenvalue being the symbol at the point u xi, and we have to choose the thing to be concentrated around u in position space, which I've already achieved by writing the left-hand side in that way, and then I'll have to choose psi minus 1 so that in the momentum space direction it's concentrated around xi as well. So you just put this in and you identify the terms term by term and you solve the relevant equations, and you discover that it is indeed possible to do what you want, and the critical function psi minus 1 is given by I xi s plus k s squared over 2 plus order of s cubed. Now, what's actually happening here, psi is a real number, and we've got e to the h inverse psi inverse, but it's I xi, so that part of it is of modulus 1. There's no decay coming from that. We're trying to get something which is concentrated around a point u and decays as you go away from that. So we need that the value k here should have negative real part. That ensures that the function you're producing decays rapidly as you go away from the point u in position space. And the condition that the real part of k is negative may be rewritten in terms of the this formula, the Poisson bracket of the real part of the symbol and the imaginary part of the symbol being positive. This is Hormando's commutator condition. Now, if you were dealing with self-adjoint operators which had real symbols, then this condition obviously can't be satisfied, and so this sort of analysis is only possible for operators which are non-self-adjoint. Remember, this is the semi-classical principal symbol of the operator. It is also the case that there's no reason why that bracket should be positive. You think the bracket of the real and the imaginary part. So you might expect that about one half of the phase space is negative and the other half of the phase space is positive. And the set omega that you're going to have to deal with is the subset of phase space for which this Poisson bracket is positive. So that specifies the set of points in phase space for which an appropriate approximate eigenfunction can be constructed. And what you get then is that by that construction, if you take a point in the appropriate part of phase space, then you can construct an approximate eigenfunction which is concentrated around the point u in position space with error h to the half, around the appropriate point in momentum space with an error of order of h to the half. But as far as the eigenvalue of the equation is concerned, you can get the power of h to be as high as you like. Now, what I'm saying there really is that you specify n first, and then that determines what approximation function f you actually produce, because you terminate the sequence at some point. So you can't improve the first two things. The uncertainty principle says you can't localize in position space and momentum space more accurately than that actually describes. But you can get the eigenvalue equation satisfied to a higher order as you like, provided you're prepared to take a large number of terms in the exponential. Now, there's another element of compromise there. The more terms you put into the exponential, the more complicated the expansion becomes. If you keep a small number of terms, then you get a lower quality expansion. And if you're going to do this numerically, you have to decide how to balance out the accuracy against the complication of the computation. So, where are we in relation to the program which I started off with at the beginning of the lecture? I had a differential operator, and I've, for the purposes of this lecture, restricted to second-order differential operators in one dimension. I have a set capital omega. This was the part of the phase space for which the Poisson bracket of the real and imaginary part of the symbol is positive. And the symbol is given by the function little sigma. So I've now told you precisely for any pseudo-differential operator what the set capital omega is. It's a certain part of the phase space. I told you what sigma is. It's the symbol of that differential operator. I've told you how to construct the operator capital E. For each point in omega, you look at the corresponding approximate eigenvector, and then you integrate those against whatever test function phi you use, and then you have to, you would hope that the operator E you get is bounded, that it has dense range, but you can't expect it to be have a bounded inverse. Now, of course, in a numerical context, it can't possibly have a dense range because you will have to take a finite set omega, not the whole of the set I've described for you, but you'll have to take a large enough finite set in order to get good approximations. Now, that, I would say, is the program as far as what I call interior pseudospectra are concerned. But there's also a notion of boundary pseudospectra. I've told you how to associate a approximate eigenfunction with every point of the, certain points in the phase space of the, associated with the space on which the pseudo-differential operator acts. But if the operator has bounded conditions, and it's defined in a bounded region, and you have bounded conditions, then you might also want to get approximate eigenfunctions which are concentrated on a path around a point of the boundary of the surface, and which decrease exponentially as you move away from that particular boundary point. And you will want to have approximate eigenfunctions which actually satisfy the boundary conditions of the differential operator exactly, not just approximately. And so I'm now going to describe how one modifies the scheme to achieve that. I'll do it again in one dimension, but this part of the analysis, I've actually shown how to develop it for a operator acting on a manifold with more or less second-order operator acting on a manifold with more or less general boundary conditions. It does require more work in higher dimensions than it does in one. Okay, so we have this differential operator. We have the semi-classical principal symbol as before. We assume the coefficients A, B, and C are all complex valued, that we have ellipticity, and I won't write down the boundary conditions for the moment because they will be brought in at the end of the lecture. So the task is to produce an approximate eigenfunction of the operator. Now, this is being done on the interval from 0 to infinity, so there's only one boundary point, that's at the origin. So when I say it's localized around the point 0 xi, 0 is the position space and xi is the momentum space variable. And we're going to adopt exactly the same strategy as before of writing down an approximate eigenfunction, ansatz of that type, putting it into the differential equation, then equating the coefficients of all orders of h and solving the equations in a hierarchical fashion. And you discover that you get the following, which appears to be exactly the same as before. Namely, you can solve the differential equation as accurately as you like with an approximate eigenfunction and the approximate eigenvalue being the value of the symbol at that point, and the critical leading term in the exponential, psi minus 1, is given by the formula which I wrote down before. However, the difference now is that when I did it before, I insisted that xi should be real because s can be both positive and negative, and you don't want exponential growth in either direction. But for the next term, k, I assumed that that had real part less than naught. But now that we know that we only have positive s, so there's no need to restrict to the case where xi is real. And instead of that, we can allow any xi, provided the real part of the imaginary part of xi is positive. So xi is no longer a point in the cotangent bundle at the boundary point. It's a point in the complexified cotangent bundle. And it's got to be a point in the complexified cotangent bundle such that if you take the component in any interior direction If you take the component in any tangential direction, you get zero imaginary parts. And if you take the components in any interior pointing direction, you get positive imaginary parts. So, if you do that, you discover that for any such psi with a positive imaginary part, you can get an approximate eigenfunction. And you appear to have actually beaten the uncertainty principle, because you've got the position operator is of order h, and the momentum operator is concentrated around psi with order h. You're not supposed to be able to do better than order h to the half. The point is that this is now not on the whole line, it's on the half line. The operator p is not supposed to satisfy any particular boundary conditions at the origin, and the uncertainty principle doesn't apply in this context. But you've got exactly the same, but now when I have this here, psi is a complex number, not a real number, and p is not a self-adjoint operator, it's just d by dx, or I d by dx, and so there's nothing inconsistent about that. Now, that gives you a solution for a particular value of xi. But that solution will not satisfy the boundary conditions which you're imposing at the point. So you need to get two different solutions and take an appropriate combination of them. This is done as follows. The value, the approximate eigenvalue is sigma. And sigma is given by the semi-classical expression, A of 0 psi squared plus B of 0 psi plus C of 0. And so if you know what your psi is, then you can work out what sigma is at that point. But there are two different psi's which give the same value of sigma. So if you know what your approximate eigenvalue is going to be, there are two choices of sigma associated with it. Psi associated with it. And you want both of them to have positive imaginary parts. And then you get two different approximate eigenvectors, both associated with the same approximate eigenvalue. That is a condition. For some psi's, for each psi, you can calculate sigma, and there is a complementary psi which has the same value of sigma. So the psi's really occur in pairs. And you're asking that both elements of the pair should have positive imaginary part. And then you get two different solutions, both of which decay exponentially as you move into the region. And by taking an appropriate combination of them, you get a set capital Xi. And so it can all be done in a manifold context. And so you get the possibility of getting a range of approximate eigenvectors associated to different points in the complexified cotangent bundle at that point, but only a part of it, the part of it for which both the number and the complementary number have positive imaginary parts. But this gives you a continuum. In some cases, there are no answers. In other cases, there's a continuum of answers. And it really, in the case of second-order differential operators, amounts to the question about whether this is an exit point for the diffusion or an entry point. Now, what do you mean by that? Second-order differential operator has a zero-order term, which we forget. It has a second-order term, which gives you a diffusion, and it has a first-order term, which gives you a drift. Now, if the drift at the origin is out of the region, in other words, to the left, then that's called an exit point, whereas if it's to the right, that's called an entry point. At exit points, you find that you get a large manifold of such solutions. And at entry points, you don't get any. So at certain boundary points, I mean, in a manifold, this is the same sort of situation. You look at the first order term, and the first order term gives you a vector in which the flow goes. And for certain parts of the boundary, the flow is going in the outward direction, and at other points, it's going in an inward direction. At every point where the first order flow is going in an outward direction, you will get a large continuum of approximate eigenvectors of this type, which actually satisfy whatever boundary condition you've had at that point. The inward pointing places, you don't get any. So that gives you a large collection of approximate eigenvectors, but it actually depends upon the geometry of the semi-classical symbol of the operator. And none of it can be applicable in the self-adjoint case. And the point is that the whole of this phenomenon is a non-self-adjoint phenomenon. In the self-adjoint case, the bracket of the real and the imaginary part is zero because the imaginary part is zero, so that aspect of the thing can't work. And on the boundary, there is no first-order flow, and so that aspect of it can't work. So both of the things I've been telling you about only are applicable because the operator is highly non-self-adjoint. If it is, then you can produce a large class of approximate eigenvectors. And of course, they're approximate in the sense that if H is sufficiently small, then you're getting very good approximations. That's, in fact, exactly the situation in which the standard types of approximations start to get into trouble. I mean, if you have a second-order term is vastly smaller than the first-order term, and that's vastly smaller than the zero-order term, then numerical schemes are actually quite often in quite a lot of trouble. In this particular scheme, the smaller h is, the better. I mean, the kind of approximation I'm talking about actually gets more accurate as h gets smaller. So it actually does well in precisely the circumstances in which the standard, so finite element type approaches, start having more difficulties. Well, I've not told you about the numerical implementation of this scheme, and nor is the numerical implementation of this scheme in anything like a final shape. I mean, what I have done so far is to solve a number of problems in one dimension and show that you can get reasonably accurate approximations by this method, and that compared with crude discretizations, it's somewhat better than the standard approach. However, I mean, that doesn't mean that it's better than all of the sophisticated ideas which have been applied to this problem. But I don't think that what I have told you either is the end point of this type of analysis. I mean, so far I've just tried to tell you why it might be possible to do this, that the existence of large numbers of approximate eigenvectors makes it highly plausible that it will work, but only in the highly non-self-adjoint case, and only in and better the smaller the value of h is. The fuller development of the idea is going to take several more years' work, and I suppose until one has done that, one won't know for what range of problems it's actually better than the existing methods.